This week on the show, the iPad magazine subscriptions go for the wallet, Google goes for the TV, and yeah, we still don't know where our local Blockbuster is. Right here on This Week in Media, number 177. Welcome back, everybody. This is Alex, and I'm coming to you from Petaluma, California. And we have a great host set up today. We've got Daisy Whitney coming in from Marin County. Evidently, she was not able to make it to Petaluma. For those of you listening, it's not very far away. Not that I'm giving her a hard time.
it's only 30 minutes, but I have to do a little visit at my son's school. I've actually been teaching. I'm an adjunct elementary school teacher. No, not really.
Adjunct.
But I've been doing a little section for his third grade class on writing. So I'm finishing it up today, and so that's why. So after TWIM, I'm just going to take off and head over to the elementary school, put on my mom hat. But anyway, it's good to be here today, though.
And we got to test the new mic, so people have to let us know what they think of the mic. But I think it sounds much better now.
Good. Yes, please, people, let us know. Tweet us, tweet Alex, and tweet me, and let us know when you're listening later in the week, or if you're listening live, if it sounds better, because I have had notorious tinny audio problems, and it could just be that I have an annoying voice too, and that won't go away.
I think you sound much better. See, I think everyone should tell Daisy that she sounds horrible on the mic, because then she still has to come up to the studio and hang out with us. I'm like afraid if she thinks the mic's too good, I'll never see her again. It'll just be at NAB in different conferences. It'll be horrible. Also coming in from Pasadena, California, we've got Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Are you getting ready for? You're going to NAB? Are you there the whole time?
I'm not there the whole time. I'm going to come in probably late Sunday night, early Monday morning after
good.
The streamies. I'm going to go to the streamies.
Oh, right. You're driving in.
And
you're pulling
the
red eye.
I'm speaking at 9 a.m., so it's going to be a long night.
I always end up getting scheduled into the 9 a.m. slot on Sunday morning at NAB, and I'm like, there's not going to be anyone there. Anyway, so I guess that's maybe a hint for me. Also coming in from Austin, Texas, we've got Brian Brushwood back. Hey, Brian.
Howdy, guys. It's good to see you again.
It's good to have you here again. And how's it? Have you fully recovered from South by Southwest?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's the last thing to recover is your voice, because that's the one thing that, you're just everywhere you go, you're just shouting at the top of your lungs. And then finally you got nothing. I sounded like I had swallowed a barbed wire grenade or something. It was just terrible. And still I'm a little bit raspy. It's been like 2 weeks.
Right.
But yes, fully recovered from South by Southwest. That was an amazing time, by the way.
Well, you're down in the middle of it. Now, is it exciting every year?
Can I tell you something weird? I've lived in Austin for 15 years and never once got to go to South by Southwest. I was either on spring break when I was in college, and after that I was booked with shows elsewhere in the country at all times. So last year was the first year I ever got to do any South by Southwest.
Wow.
And they worked me like a dog. In 3 days, I had a lecture that I gave at South by Southwest, the Scam Your Way Into Anything panel. I did appearances on Totally Rad Show, Dignation Live, and we shot 8 episodes of Scam School, all in this 3-day period. So I didn't get to do any of it. So this was literally the first year I got to go to any of the parties and see any of the people, and it was a total blast. By the way, did you see the little video that Glenn put together with the Dignation crew? Was like 2,100 photos all put to music.
I did not.
Yeah, it's really, really, really good looking. It's and they were all nice photos to begin with, and it really captures the manic energy. I'll see if I can send a link and post it up in the chat room.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds great. So jumping into the news here, we've got a lot of news here today. This is a busy week. Of course, the iPad is being released on Saturday. It's showing up. I mean, someone might have it on.
If you didn't pre-order, are you totally hosed?
Yeah, you're host, pretty much. If you haven't pre-ordered it now, the new ship date is the 12th. So they pushed it out. They said that's the earliest you're going to get it if you order one now. I have maybe 2 on order.
intentional, because it seemed to me like Nintendo with the Wii intentionally underproduced so it could be perpetually sold out and be this big phenomenon. Do you think they're playing a bit of that game, or do you think they just underestimated the demand?
The rumor is that they didn't underestimate the demand. They just literally can't make them any faster. I mean, they're trying to, you know, the problem that Apple has in general is that it is very, very tight specs for everything that they make. And so, you know, there's just a high failure rate on a lot of the stuff because it's the way they want to package it and the way they want to set it up. And it sounds like that's all they could produce. It sounds like they're shooting for 5 to 10 million this year. They're definitely, and I don't think Apple is in the position where they need to prove that people want their products anymore. So I think that they
decide what people want. We've decided right. You will love this.
Well, the other thing is that you want to make sure that people are subscribing to overpriced magazine subscriptions, as in our first story here. We're throwing this into
what you're talking about.
Yeah. So Daisy, tell us about this. This is the Wall Street Journal is coming to the iPad.
Yeah, there's a lot of we're starting to get news on how much different subscriptions are going to be priced at, and I've got some predictions and data I can share as well on what some experts are thinking we might wind up seeing in terms of actual demand for these. But Henry Blodgett, former stock analyst and now does Silicon Alley Insider and Business Insider and just a wonderful sort of media iconoclast, had a brief post last week saying fancy Wall Street Journal iPad edition will cost $17.99 a month, which is pretty much twice what it costs for your subscription to the online Wall Street Journal. I guess I just don't know who would pay that. I don't get it. I don't understand how they could double the price. I'm sure it's just a fantastic experience on the iPad and all of that. But really, who would pay double when it's hard enough to get? I mean, granted, the Wall Street Journal is one of the few publications that's been successful in getting people to pay for subscriptions.
We're talking, of course, about the Wall Street Journal, and plenty of people there have plenty of money. And evidently, they think that they're going to be willing to share it with the Wall Street Journal. Brian, is this dog going to hunt?
You totally fooled me with that voice. I was like, what did we get another panelist? What just happened? He's a wizard. Look, the people who are going to pay this are the same people who buy iPads. If you're somebody who's going to buy a redundant device that's essentially an extraordinarily pretty netbook, you're also the kind of person who will pay this just so you could get the prettiest, most aesthetically wonderful experience possible. And I actually think I think it'll do all right, to be honest, because if you're the type of person that says, I don't want to spend that kind of money just for the Wall Street Journal, you're also the type of person who'd be like, oh, plus I can already see everything for free on my existing hardware in the other room.
Tim, how do you sell this?
You sell it by having content that goes there first. So you're paying that premium, but you're getting content that you can't get anywhere else. That's how you do it.
Do you think that it's going to be content that is only seen on the iPad?
I think there's a huge opportunity for that for the magazines. And, this is the way to put the genie back in the bottle. So what happens? Are we going to see their websites have less information, or will it be later it goes to the website? Don't know yet, but it'll be interesting to see.
I mean, it seems like that the only way you can sell this is to have enough people who are willing to pay for it. But once you get to that point, it gets to, just put all the custom stuff up, put stuff that's only available on the iPad and all the extra interactive stuff. And that's the only way you're going to be able to sell charging more. So anyway, we'll see how this goes. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of different, all of them look like they're not very competitive when it comes to pricing. So we'll see.
Here's the other thing too, is I think this is probably a smart move in that there's only one, this is one of the more expensive subscriptions out there, and when it gets people talking about it. So as a publicity move, it's probably a good thing. And keep in mind, you can always reduce the price later over time, but it's going to be harder, I would imagine, to creep it up. We saw the same thing with iPhone apps. When they first came out, it was, $10, $15 for a little video game, and then they figured out, oh, wait, nobody just jumps and spends $10 for a little racing game, but they will spend $1.99 or $1, and the volume goes way, way up. So we may see something like that as well.
Right. So ComScore says that you're ready for more ads for your video content. Daisy, what's this all about?
Well, there was a great where this was written about. There was a great point that so basically, ComScore has done consumer research in terms of the number, the amount. We're usually seeing take Hulu as kind of a good barometer, about 4 minutes of ads for each hour of content. That's from the ComScore study, and ComScore has looked at, what is sort of the consumer tolerance, and basically its feedback from the marketplace is that we would tolerate more, possibly 6 to 7 minutes worth. And to that end, CW just recently started pretty much doubling the ad load in its online episodes of its TV shows. There's an article about that in last week's Wall Street Journal, I believe, as well, kind of detailing that they're moving forward with that. Anthony Suhu at CBS, who is sort of a thought leader and heads up a lot of the digital ad sales efforts and digital initiatives at CBS, has also floated that idea in terms of increasing the ad load. And ABC has similarly done studies saying that consumers still recall the brands that they see. But the great point in this blog post, it said, you know, it's kind of a bit like TSA, you know, and the writer says, I've long argued that we should be willing to let the airport security people do their job to help protect us, that I'm fine removing my shoes if the trade-off is more security for air travelers like myself. However, when I'm actually standing in line, loading my shoes in a plastic bin, it's more annoying than my theoretical self imagined. And I think that's sort of the risk here, that this is an interesting research study. And if you called me up and said, Daisy, would you be willing to tolerate more ads to continue to get shows for free instead of watching them through a cable subscription? I would say yes. But when it comes down to it, do I want to see the stupid Latisse ad for eyelash, extendable makeup, whatever prescription thing that I've seen 20 times on Hulu again? No, I don't. Well, and I think Hulu- it's risky. I think this type of data is risky, but I also think it is an inevitability in the marketplace. It's going to happen. There'll be more ads.
Well, I mean, the an hour per broadcast is 16 minutes, right? Or roughly? 15
yeah, we're
or
getting
16
six, yeah, we're getting 16 to 20 minutes in an hour-long show. But the thing is, do we have that same tolerance online? Yes, we've been trained to watch ads that way on the TV. But I think the question is now, it's kind of like what Brian and Tim are saying about the prices for iPad apps. I mean, it's putting the genie back in the bottle. Look, maybe it'll happen. And I think it has to happen. I think that, but I think there will be a lot of resistance and a lot of grumbling. And I think that's something that networks are going to have to find a way to deal with because of all the things we discuss on this show and on other shows, that consumers now have a much larger voice and big megaphones thanks to social media. And they'll grumble and they'll complain about the ad load.
Brian, do you see, is this the only way to pay for this content? Is this the way that we're going to have to do this to make this all work?
You know, I don't know. Personally, I would love it if I could just, you know, give all cable traditional media the boot, and I would give that same amount of money, like literally, and maybe even more, maybe even pay more just for it to have Hulu be a subscription-based thing where everything I ever wanted was always there and always available. And you know what? They could even get away with putting a few ads in there on top of that. That's how much I can't stand the traditional cable appointment viewing that you have with these channels, and you can only watch one at a time, and you have to randomly know when your television is on.
Yeah, but do we really have that existence anymore with DVRs and everything else? I mean, it seems like I'm pretty much disconnected from the time.
Even though the DVR, though, like I have to the interface on my Time Warner high def cable box is so obtuse, it's so Byzantine that it's like I've tried three times to set up a subscription, and I just like screw it, I'll find it, I'll wait a day and see it on Hulu. Like I couldn't even be bothered to find the program and the day it was on in order to set up a subscription for it.
Tim, do you think we are on our way to 16 minutes an hour?
Do we have an ad for the show this week?
We don't.
This would be a really good time.
We are ad free here at This Week in Media. We're looking out for your best interests.
There you go. You know, I look at magazines. I mean, some people buy magazines like the fashion magazines. They buy them for the ads. They like the ads more than they like the articles. So I think that if the advertising.
So you're saying that the key is that they have to have strong advertising. I mean, the advertising has to be good.
Strong, relevant advertising will win out every time. If it's crap, if it's annoying, if it's in your face, who wants it? And how effective is it going to be? You know, I was wondering about spam. How does spam work? I mean, it costs nothing.
Somebody clicks on it.
Somebody must click on it, but who? I don't know. Have you guys ever bought any spam stuff?
I am waiting for your call for date.
Wait, is there
I am looking. I am 29 and I am lonely.
Yeah, and I'm from Nigeria. My uncle, the general, needs some money.
Well, and I have to admit, you know, like here's the worst part is I'll be fast scanning through, and this is how bad I am with my iPhone, is I'm fast forwarding through through commercials on, you know, through my on my DVR, and I see an Apple commercial, and I stop and rewind to see what are the new apps that they're showing.
It's relevant.
Yeah, it's like exactly what I want to know. And the same with, did you guys see the Hampton Inn that was doing the ads on Hulu a couple years ago? There's it was Find Your Safe Place. Oh, Find a Safe Place. Anyway, it was these It was basically people doing something very uncomfortable. So they were, you know, a woman.
You're talking about comfort in. The
comfort
in.
Find your comfort zone.
Fantastic.
And the thing is,
that was the dog poop bag ad.
Yeah. And the dog. I'm known for being in the dog poop bad ad. So anyway, so the. But it was so funny that I actually, in Hulu, you had this ability to watch all of them. So I got to some commercial break and then I just ended up watching all of them because it was actually better than whatever show I was watching on Hulu.
That's something that Hulu does that I really love is where they get to have you define your own advertising experience. I remember actually getting excited about, I think there was the ads that they did for Halo ODST were really good. They looked like the new Battlestar Galactica. They were really gritty and interesting to watch. And so you had a choice. You could either watch, you know, a full 3-minute trailer. And I was actually stoked. In fact, when we went to watch another movie or another show on Hulu, when I came up with like some makeup ad, I actually hit reload because I wanted to get that ad so I could show it to my wife the second time. So it's right. Like, you know, there is, and people roll their eyes like, oh, who likes ads? Nobody likes ads. And yet here we are talking about our favorite ads and the ones that made us chuckle or feel one thing or another.
Well, I mean, when the Steelers aren't playing in the Super Bowl, all I care about is the ads. You know, like I just fast forward. I just reverse the DVR experience and just see, okay. What, and now that it's on YouTube, we don't even need to. So this actually brings us to our next subject, which is that we've got Google TV, and they're trying to create this new little box, and we're trying to get our head around what they're trying to create. Daisy, what's actually going on here?
Yeah, we've been following this story and tracking it, and have sort of touched on different aspects of it over the last few episodes, and there continues to be more information that we're learning. And my colleague Will Richmond did another excellent post. I've given him many shout outs here, but I think he's really doing a terrific job following the story. So you can tune into his posts, his daily blogs at videonews.com, N-U-Z-E.com. So he did a little more research on it. And basically what Google is trying to do, it's going to have its own set-top box, essentially. So it's definitely making a box. But it's not designed to encourage consumers and TV users to cut the cord and become cord cutters. But it's designed to essentially daisy chain, you know, kind of work in conjunction with or on top of existing multi-channel program distributors. So Google could work with, I don't know that it would be a Comcast or anybody that large. Of course, it's not inconceivable. Comcast did do a deal with TiVo a few years ago, which has kind of come to nothing. But nevertheless, what could be interesting is you hear about these kind of alternative service providers cropping up and then, of course, there are the telcos. There are, you know, Verizon, AT&T, so on and so forth, that are developing and are already out in the marketplace with their own multi-channel video services. But I think for a lot of sort of the smaller ISPs, rural ISPs that are still trying to have a video service or are launching it, you know, Google's really trying to position itself as an option. Another company that is doing something similar is Sezmi, S-E-Z-M-I, which launched in Los Angeles, I believe, late last year. And again, it's designed to be a new type of cable service provider. So it reminds me, what Google's trying to do reminds me a little bit of what Sezmi is trying to do, which is basically to piggyback and be a partner of other multi-channel video service providers. So I think that's sort of an interesting approach. I'd be curious to hear what you guys think about it.
The idea is that this pipes into it goes out of your cable box into your Google box, and then out of your Google box into your TV. And so Google Box is kind of a middleware. Brian, how does this make sense?
Sign me up instantly. If I could get an Apple TV-like interface and not have to know when shows are on or what channels are on or whatever, but just pick what I like and then make it available, if somebody would broker that for me in a digital form, instantly I'll keep my subscription. If I could get a Hulu-like experience while still going with traditional cable and everyone's still happy and I still get all my shows, then
so in some ways this is a layer on top of it where you don't have to change the way you're doing it. The cable networks don't have to change what they're doing. Everyone can kind of go about their business, but simply you know, have this intermediate that kind of sorts all that stuff out for them, lets them search. Of course, it sends a lot of information back to Google about how people are sorting it out, which would be very useful if you want to, you know, sell search ads.
You know, what would be interesting is if they actually worked out agreements to where when you hit the commercial break, they swap out an ad they suspect you won't like, and Google Eyes put in an ad that they suspect you will like or will watch. or even if, what if I hate thinking this way, but what if the trade-off is like Google handles all the media and it gets everything to you, but you have this Hulu thing where you can't skip the commercials? Because if that's what you're using is the Google TV box, then they could control that kind of thing.
Do we worry about, I mean, with our Google already sees how we search. Are we worried about, Tim, are we worried about privacy issues, or is this just going to be something we're worried about for the first 6 months and then we don't know about it anymore or don't care?
Absolutely. I'm cutting all my cables today. I'm scared to death. It's just like anything. Everybody, the people that are always scared about privacy are going to be scared about privacy. I mean, you have no privacy anymore. What I'm really curious about in this thing is, how's the box going to get into the house? Do you buy it at Best Buy? Do you order it online? Or does somebody come out to your house to hook it up? Because in the cable world, they hate sending a technician to the house because that's an opportunity for them to track dirt into the house, you know, walk in with their utility boots and get the housewife's carpet all dirty. This is stuff that costs them money. And, rolling a truck costs money.
It seems like something that's pretty simple technology that's sitting just in between. There's nothing to do other than plug it into your cable box and plug it into your TV.
Hey, if it's like a Roku and you can order it online, it gets emailed, but FedEx to your house. Yeah, that's cool. It's great. I just had the Wii disc for Netflix show up at my house. So I now have Netflix on my Wii. So the Roku is moving to the bedroom, and the living room now has the Wii.
I think we just found the title for our show. I have Netflix on my Wii. Yeah, I think that's perfect. Daisy?
There you go.
I was going to say, it's also possible that we as consumers would never actually have to see this box. I mean, it could be a true set-top box that lives in our home, but another option is it could be something that exists as part of the head end. I mean, there are different options that are being floated and we don't know for sure, but I think that Tim's point is good, is that whoever is involved, whether it's Google working with a Verizon or even with a Comcast or just with a small sort of, 500,000 sub cable operator, those things could be figured out. Do they want to have the headache of having this be sold in retail chains, or is this something where it becomes sort of purely software, or it's a box that we never have to see that exists, like I said, on the back end, in the head end, in those other places where we don't have to interact with it ourselves.
But in some ways, doesn't that defeat what Google wants to do? Because the thing is the problem when you don't put it in someone's house and you don't have a keyboard is that you have a very limited experience. I mean, there's just only a handful of pipes. I mean, I love the Roku. It's a great thing. But if I trying to get around finding the stuff that I've already saved, it can be a little annoying. I mean, I have 260 things in my queue, so I think that's part of my problem. But it's just like, oh yeah, I got to get to that movie that's on the other side, and there's just a lot of clicking from one side to the other.
How spoiled are we? Listen to me. I was like, oh, there's so many button clicks.
I have so much content around. I simply can't find it.
The interface on the Wii is laid out a little bit better, where you can navigate through the different genres, and you can also access your instant queue, which you can't do.
Well, I mean, I can on my Roku. I mean, that is what I have access to, is my instant queue.
No, can you go to your instant queue add stuff? You can't do that.
No, as Brian said, we're oppressed people here. We are not able to. I have to sit there with my laptop and add them while I'm watching TV.
It's
a horrible experience.
But that may change with the iPad.
Yeah, exactly, Brian.
As on the Google TV thing, it's like I would love it if, and I don't know how far along they are in the development process, if they're ready to make this happen, but it sounds to me like they really need to clearly define the benefit with Google TV. And if it is a case where all of a sudden it brings a much better, because that's something universally, I think just about everyone hates the interface for their cable box, their DVR and their channel flipping experience, compared to something like, a TiVo or a Hulu or a Apple TV. And if it is a case where they're just bringing this experience, I almost wonder if they wouldn't partner with the cable companies where you don't even have to buy the box, but for another $4.99 per month, you get the Google TV experience.
So we'll have to see. It's going to be very interesting. It is going to be interesting, as Tim alluded to, what's going to happen when we have an iPad that might control the TV or might interact with the Apple TV or iPhone interacting closer. So we'll have to see. Coming up next, we've got the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is going to start funding local reporting projects. Daisy, tell us more.
Yes, this is a story from the New York Times, from some of the blogs on the New York Times, that the CPB is basically looking to counter what it sees as a decline in local journalism and original reporting nationwide. News bulletin, news flash reporting is not what it used to be. But that's kind of what's happening here. What we've touched on over the last year and in a number of different episodes is obviously with everything that's happening to newspapers in particular, which are really often on the front lines in terms of uncovering and really reporting on just investigative stories in communities, but really sort of unearthing things that can be very important for citizens to know about. So now you have the Corporation for Public Broadcasting saying that it's making funding available to set up 7 regional reporting projects. There'll be collaborative efforts between public radio and TV stations. And I guess what fascinates me about this, Alex, is a total of about 50 jobs will be created by this by the CPB, and the CPB actually is going to invest about $7.5 million in the project over 2 years, with another $3 million coming from local stations. So $10.5 million coming into journalism funding. But what's interesting to me is this whole idea of journalism funding, and I wonder if it's becoming like art, you know, something that is shifting to a funded sort of philanthropic business.
But, you know, beyond, I don't know. I mean, we think of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting it is funded by donations, but they may have some real business reasons why they have to do this. If they don't have the kind of reporters, I mean, one of the things that you're looking at is I don't almost ever listen to NPR on the radio anymore. You know, it is very, very rare for me to do that because I have an iPhone app that I can sit there and I can turn off the stuff that I want and turn, you know, I can listen to the shows. I can skip all the stuff at the end of the hour, which is stuff I hate. And so the, you know, there's all this, you got to admit, I mean, it's just like,
when they ask for money,
your news and your current events and your important things to think about. You're keeping me from wait, don't tell me. Now get out of here.
Yeah, no, it's just like no. At the end of the hour, it's always like, well, we had to fill the hour up somehow, and so we had these stories that we recorded at sometime in the last 6 months, and we're just gonna kind of throw. They're like, we're just gonna throw those in. I feel really bad if someone watching is someone who works on those, but it just drives me crazy. So anyway, I can delete all those, and I can delete all the Sarah Palin ones because I don't really need to listen to them anymore. I mean, I kind of know what she's going to say. And so, so I can pick and choose, you know, which ones I want. Why would I want to go back? So the problem is, though, is that this takes away from a lot of the local stations, you know, so now not as people are watching the local stations because NPR, for instance, is centralizing all of that. All the funding theoretically is going to NPR. Is this going to be a problem? Tim, do you think this is a systematic problem for these corporations who have depended on this grassroots effort of reporters for up until now?
No, this is something that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been doing since like 1969. People just don't know about it because I think it all started out with what was that reporter's name?
Kermit T. Frog here, and I'm reporting live from.
I mean, they've been doing it forever. It's right. Just been disguised. So, I mean, this sounds like a non-story to me.
Okay.
Well, okay, I've got to jump in here for a sec. I don't think what is important here is not so much that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is funding reporting, because obviously that's something that has been going on for a long time. It's that it's specifically going to be funding a lot of local journalism. And I think that what we have to pay attention to is that this is not a standalone effort. This is not the first time. I mean, this is sort of one of a lot of efforts we've been starting to see from NPR and from others to invest money because journalism, and specifically the quality of it, and investigative stories and things like that are starting to fall by the wayside because it takes time and it takes money to do that. And I think that it's not so much that CPB is doing this, but it's more, I think what the takeaway from here is just what does it say about models for journalism, specifically the business model for journalism? And I have to wonder how long, you know, is there a truly sustainable one for local journalism? That, I think, is what's potentially concerning.
What are the output channels for the journalism? I mean, this would just show up on NPR radio, or would these show up as a series of YouTube clips? I mean, how does one receive the benefits of the local journalism?
Well, I think that for a project like this, I think that remains to be seen. I would have to imagine that they will be distributed across a number of venues. I think it'll be across radio, across TV stations, across YouTube, and so on and so forth. I think it says that this is going to be the beginning of a shift in terms of how journalism is being, not all of it. I mean, Fox News Channel doesn't need to do this, but I think it's the beginning of a shift in terms of how a lot of the stories that we've been used to receiving, maybe we don't care about them anymore.
Which is funny because...
No, that might be the case. We might just not care that much anymore, and therefore it has to be philanthropic.
Well, I think that the other thing, though, is that it's obviously more interesting sometimes to listen to international or more national affairs. The funny thing is that really the news that's local is really the only thing that affects us on a day-to-day basis, because we're much more interested in listening to, you know, where Barack Obama is or what he's doing. But the fact that our mayor here in Petaluma probably has more of an effect on my day-to-day life, you know, than Barack Obama, is always a fascinating thing. I mean, a lot of these national issues are a theoretical issue, you know, really. I mean, we get worried about it and we wonder what's going to happen, and eventually it'll trickle down to us and have some kind of effect. But you know, whether the garbage gets picked up on Friday morning does very much affect my life with my wife.
Michael Crichton in one speech said that there's nothing more sobering than a 30-year-old newspaper. He was doing some research trying to find giant disasters to write books about. And in looking at 30-year-old newspapers, he was shocked because he couldn't recognize any of the names that seemed so important at the time or any of the issues that everybody was worried about, whether it was going to go one way or the other. So that's where he adopted his, whatever will happen.
Yeah, yeah. So the... Microsoft, we're going to move on here. Microsoft Silverlight is now on 60% of all the internet devices. I don't know exactly what they define as internet devices, but it's 60% of something. And this looks like they're finally reaching some kind of critical mass. Do we think that Silverlight, I will say, is a very, very, very good technology, but do we think this is actually going to be able to take a toehold? Daisy?
I'm going to throw this to Brian and Tim, because I think they're probably much more astute observers than myself in terms of the benefits and disadvantages of either Silverlight or Flash. But I think what's interesting is sort of to figure out, is Silverlight kind of quietly, I mean, it's not as if it's been quiet, but certainly the debates that we all hear about are much more Flash and HTML related. And I just wonder if Silverlight is kind of slowly but steadily going to become some new type of standard. I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Tim?
Well, I think that if the Windows phone takes off, if that gets hold, then Silverlight will happen with Silverlight. I mean, it's slowly happening now, but it's still hard to author in Silverlight. You can't export from Final Cut Pro to Silverlight. So, you know, there's some hoops to jump through. But from an enterprise standpoint, it's a very slick technology. It's a great solution on an enterprise level. It's just... for all the independents that are out there creating content,
I will say that
it's a little bit of a hurdle.
The playback on Silverlight is great. You know, and the stuff that the people who are using it are great. I mean, you know, the quality that's coming out is really fantastic.
Netflix uses Silverlight,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's great.
Just stunning quality, and it's a great technology. A couple of interesting things though is that it is it's not supported on the iPhone or iPad, which is going to be, you know, a growing problem, I think, for a lot of people. That's why we're seeing a lot of this HTML5. I mean, one of the related stories is CBS is, you know, going to be having HTML5 video distribution for their shows, because of course they want it to be able to play on every device. You know, and I think that's one of the issues. I think also that I do think something you pointed on, Tim, that's really important is the fact that the authoring is very difficult, because, and I personally think that this is actually something that Apple misses too. They have a lot of basic authoring, but being able to author interactively, the reason Flash, I think, got as popular as it has been is because there was a Flash authoring tool that was really good, and it was largely based on the director. I mean, well, not based on director, but had a lot, like if you had used director, you could move on to Flash and, you know, do a lot of cool things with it. And I think that one of the reasons that we saw that is people could do that. And we haven't seen that with other interactive platforms where there's a great, easy to use tool that allows people to make stuff quickly. And I think that, and I think both Apple and Microsoft have to pay attention to the fact that Adobe has that. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how that goes. I do think that, you know, it's going to be a challenge for Microsoft to continue to grow it if they're not getting supported on two very large platforms, or one very large platform. So that's going to be the piece that they have there. The Warner Brothers and Blockbuster renew their rental pact. Daisy, tell us more.
Yeah, so Hollywood Reporter reported last week that, and Warner Brothers has really sort of been this interesting focus group litmus test of what Hollywood studios are doing and trying in terms of different windows with DVD and online and so on. And as you guys know, there's now this 28-day window from when the DVD is released till Redbox is able to pick it up, until Netflix as well is able to offer it and to stream it. And they did these deals to sort of get larger access to content for streaming and for online, and in Redbox's case, just in general for availability. But when Blockbuster renewed its pact, it's going to have the same day release window, that basically Blockbuster will be able to rent its films the day they're made available on DVD, which gives it a 4-week head start over Netflix and Redbox. And I don't think that, one deal with one studio is necessarily enough to pull Blockbuster back. We know this is a company that is definitely beleaguered. Although I have to say, whenever we do Blockbuster stories, I do hear from a lot of folks in a lot of places who say, that's still where I rent from. I still get movies from Blockbuster. So even if we're not using it regularly, it's important to think that a lot of people are definitely still going there. But I guess what I'm curious about is, could this be, does this kind of keep Netflix in check with its streaming ambitions, and does this give Blockbuster any sort of leg up at all that it can do something with to come back as a meaningful player?
Brian, do you think you're going to go back to Blockbuster now that you can get the 30 days?
The question I had was whether or not, did this apply just to streaming content or even physical media? I guess somehow I didn't know that Netflix has to wait 4 weeks after the DVD is available. Is that for even their...
Because you didn't care. Email?
What's that?
You didn't know because you didn't care.
No, I'm 100% streaming. If it's not streaming, I don't even bother.
But I'm saying you didn't care whether it was out the day the DVD was released or whether it was a month later. I mean, if you didn't see it in the theater, you don't really pay much attention.
Correct. Yeah, that you exactly nailed it. And it's the kind of thing where it's literally I have in my email folder a list of the top 10 movies from last year that I never got around to see. And I'm slowly ticking them off now, trying to get as much of the experience as I can.
Right. I mean, I just know that when I see the ads, oh, yeah, the DVD is available now. Okay, maybe I'll go get it. Or maybe I'll look at it Netflix. Then I go up to Netflix and it's not there. And I'm like, well, I'll wait until Netflix has it. Tim, do you think this is going to help Blockbuster?
Do you remember when Blockbuster did the deal, the broadband deal with Enron? Do you remember that? They did.
Astute these guys are.
They did a deal with Enron and the whole thing fell apart. Can you imagine that? I think Hollywood does need Blockbuster, or they need Hulu. They need something to keep Netflix, and cutting this deal. I don't know that it's going to save Blockbuster.
But well, I mean, it seems like
what Daisy's saying.
I think that does it seem like old Hollywood is trying to keep some of their old friends in there because they have, especially in media distribution, it seems like they have three really fast growing companies that are smart, and smarter than they are, to be honest with you. I mean, Apple, Google, and Netflix, when it comes to distributing content, are, in my opinion, pretty much the top of the heap. They do the right things. They get the content done right. They get the distribution right. It's all in different ways, but they're doing it really, really well. And Hollywood, do you think this scares Hollywood?
I think this is a case where it's Hollywood sitting at its big, fat, fancy desk counting its monies, and it's got friends with Netflix and Hulu, and in walks what he first thinks is a hobo walking in with all shabby clothes and the big, bushy beard. It's like, hey, it's me. It's Blockbuster, remember? Hey, how about a job? And Hollywood's like, yeah, whatever. Here, you got a 4-week head start. Now I'm sure it'll all turn around for you, guy. And then get out of here.
Tim, do you think
just doing a favor is all.
Do you think...
For time's sake.
Tim, what do you think?
I don't know what's in the future for Blockbuster. It's going to be pretty hard for them to come back and beat Netflix unless the studios prop them up. And that seems to be what's happening.
Right. Daisy, do you know where your local Blockbuster is?
Yes, I don't go there. From time to time, I go to the very, very indie rental store that's one town over because they have Disney movies, and those are very hard to rent from any place else. And I have young children.
But oddly, not very hard to rip.
So yeah, from time to time I'll go to the video store, but like I said, it's real. It's mostly just for something like that, where Disney has really sort of masterminded that scarcity model when it comes to releasing a lot of its. And I know Tim is still working on his princess phase, so he might be going through the same experience that I am as well, when he has to track down the Little Mermaid and, you know, Beauty and the Beast and things.
Jasmine.
And yeah, exactly, and Jasmine, Aladdin, and things like that. So yeah, other than that,
when I saw the story,
I'm with Brian. I'm streaming.
When I saw this story go by, I was like, so where is the Blockbuster? You know, I was like, I know it's around here somewhere. I just don't know exactly where. So,
or you know what else, Alex? It's probably shut down. I mean, my husband and I were in Sausalito a couple of weeks ago, and we were going to, you know, take the dog to a park or something. I go, yeah, isn't it right near where that video rental is? He goes, you know, that store closed 3 years ago. I go, oh, okay.
You're saying, Brian?
Oh, well, two things. First of all, I think Blockbuster, first of all, probably still serves a little bit of a purpose in that if it's Friday night and you have family over and you're all talking about how you wanted to see Star Trek and you missed it in the theater and it just came out that day, you don't have any other option. It's not available for streaming, and you will go make the 20-minute drive to go pick up the movie so that you can make it happen in, you know, there with the family. But actually, in that case, you're probably just as likely to go buy the movie for $22 just to have the problem handled. But the other thing is, while none of us know where our local Blockbuster are, because none of us care because we have that need serviced through a different method, we all probably know where our local quirky video places. There's a place called Vulcan Video here in Austin that specializes in super rare, hard to find movies and bootlegs, and I know where both locations of that are.
Well, and that's the interesting thing is that a lot of times that niche, being able to find specifically what makes you different, I think is going to be key for any retailer. You know, just being another one that can do it. You don't want to get into these arguments. You don't want to get into a fight with Walmart or Blockbuster or Apple. I mean, these are people who are much bigger, and you got to find where you fit in. So, speaking of someone who has figured out where to fit in, Fred, the movie has been snatched up by Nickelodeon. Daisy, what? Who's Fred?
Fred is Lucas Cruikshank, and he is, well, now he's the second most popular YouTube creator.
Why are we even talking about him? He's only the second most popular.
I know.
On YouTube.
It's really embarrassing that he's only got 1.6 million subscribers to his videos and usually gets 4 million views.
Maybe
per
I'll lend him a few of mine, you know, because I have so many.
Exactly. Give him a little extra, push him back to number one.
Exactly.
So he's this, you know, he's a 16-year-old, just a huge YouTube star. And, you know, he's had deals with advertisers. He's got some deals with movie studios. And he's been talking about making this Fred the Movie, you know, on his own, possibly doing it for YouTube. But now it's official, and Nickelodeon has picked it up. It's just, you know, I think what's interesting is he's done some guest spots on the Nickelodeon show iCarly. And there's not necessarily a lot there to this story, but I think it's important because I see him really as sort of one of the first big crossover stars. This is something that we looked out for a lot back when I was at TV Week, you know, sort of what would make the jump from the web to TV. You know, we had Quarter Life, and obviously we talked about that ad nauseum when that failed on TV, and really just kind of looking at, you know, what makes that transition, what plays in one world and also in this more traditional world. And I think it'll be interesting to see. And part of me thinks, you know, that these crossover stars really are a little bit of a lightning in a bottle, once in a lifetime phenomenon. Somebody like a Susan Boyle, it's very rare for someone to make that kind of a jump, and it's very rare for someone to have that type of a video that gets as many views as her video did.
Brian, are you trying to cross over?
Yes, I can't wait to make the leap to Nickelodeon. You know, I wonder if it's a case where the kid is just good talent. You know, if he has a movie, my guess is it wasn't because his videos were so great, but because he was partly lightning in a bottle, like you mentioned, Daisy, because he was in the right place at the right time. But when you have that much attention on you, and if you're right for a Nickelodeon type movie, then it seems like that's going to happen, and that's going to be where you end up.
Do you think this is a key for people, Tim, that to get to that other side, to get that larger audience?
you know, it's a great way. I mean, there's a window of opportunity that's open right now, and I don't know how long it is going to be open, but, you know, as long as the internet stays the way that it is, it gives independents like Lucas, who plays Fred, gives him a chance to get out there and build a brand. Unfortunately for Lucas, when he started out, he built this online following, and then he got some managers who weren't, to my knowledge, weren't that experienced and didn't get him a lot of the deals that a bigger agency could have got him. And now he's signed with a different manager, and he's also with UTA. And I think that's helped a lot. I spent some time at South by Southwest with his manager and actually Mark, the guy who wrote the story about this. And he said, you know, a lot of offers were coming in and things were really looking up for Fred. So I think it's a brand that's there to grow. It'll be interesting to see how Lucas can handle it, because he's not going to look the same in two more years. I mean, he's changed a lot already, and that always, you know, affects child stars.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out.
I'd be interested to know how many of us have seen more than one episode or even one full complete episode of Fred's postings on YouTube. I have.
Oh, really? Yeah. Fred Goes Swimming. Check that one out. That's a good one.
That's a really funny one. I watched one.
Actually, I was like, I think I got the joke now.
I haven't made it through a whole one yet. But I'm too old. I've just decided I'm just too old
adults.
And curmudgeon. It's for kids, and kids love them, and, you know, we'll let them have that. Brian, where can people find you?
At scamschool.tv, where every Thursday we have a new episode of Scam School. Tuesday nights we are live doing NSFW. We call it the new show Full of Win with my co-host, Mr. Justin Roberts Young. And of course, all my goings on are at schwood.com. That's SHWOOD.com. Schwood on Twitter. I love you.
Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com. Also have a new business podcast coming out, hopefully this week. First episode will be out. It's called SM Biz. So look for that on iTunes.
Excellent. And Daisy, where can people find you?
You can find me at daisywhitney.com, where you can watch my new Media Minute. I also write articles for many places. And if you follow me on Twitter, you will get to read most of those. And I'm on Amazon now, because
you can pre-order
The Mockingbirds. It comes out in 7 months, I know, a long way away, but feel free to pre-order it. Just search for my name or search for The Mockingbirds on Amazon. Pre-order it. Thank you. Fantastic.
This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.